the tabletop. Take away
game mechanics on display.
Three designers share the stage.
Pick a genre and we'll play
the tabletop. Take away.
Welcome back to the Tabletop Takeaway. I'm Ananda Gunaratna.
I'm Charlie McCarron.
And I'm Trevor Muller-Hagel.
And today we are going to talk about Studies in Sorcery, our second game in our engine building series. So in Studies in Sorcery, you are a student at a magical academy for the dark arts, and it is your final semester, and you are trying to be the valedictorian by getting the best grades, by turning in the best projects, and that's the theme of the game. So the way that it works is there's a bunch of project cards that you're trying to complete, so sort of a, you know, order completion type thing. Each project requires certain materials to complete it. In order to get those materials, you're going to have to go and rob some graves, because this is an Academy of the Dark Arts. So the way that you rob the graves is there are three piles of graves, and you search them using a Winston draft. So if you haven't heard of a Winston draft, basically the way it works is there's three piles, each having some number of cards in them. And you look at the piles one at a time, and the piles are face down. And if you like what you see, you can keep all the cards in that pile. And if you don't like what you can see, you can add a card to the top of the pile and then go to the next pile and look at it. And you keep going until... if you don't like any of the piles, you can just take a card from the deck, or you can also take one of the face-up generic stock items, which are useful for some of the projects. So the game takes place over a fixed number of rounds. There's 16 rounds in the game, split into 4 months. Each month has 4 phases of the moon for a total of 16 rounds. And at the end of 16 rounds, you see who's completed the most projects. Every turn, you get to take an action, which is grave robbing or taking projects from the market, well, buying them by selling jewelry and other stuff that you've robbed from the graves. Or you can also cram by committing more things to projects in order to try to get them complete. Because in particular, you are limited in how many ingredients you can commit to your projects. So each turn, you're allowed to commit 2 ingredients, just for free, every turn. But if you cram, you can commit an additional 2.
We're just a little distracted. We have a special guest on the podcast today, Trevor's dog, Leia.
Hi, Leia. Say hi to everyone. Oh, she's done. She's good now.
Yep.
She's confused.
But
so where were we? Studies in Sorcery.
Studies in Sorcery, yes. So, yeah, so basically every turn you're going to get ingredients, get projects, and then you can commit 2 ingredients to your projects to try to complete them. The projects, I think, usually use between 2 and 5 ingredients maybe, but some of them use more, like the abomination that I made required, I think, 9 ingredients. Anyway, and then the projects are worth points, and you see who has the most points at the end. And the projects also give you special abilities, which is where the engine building comes into play. Some of the projects give you new actions that you can use on your turn. Some of them give passive bonuses that trigger when other players do something or that improve your own actions. Some of them only work during certain phases of the moon. And
yeah,
there's a lot of different ones.
I like that part of it with the moon phases triggering actions, because sometimes in engine builders... you get overwhelmed by like the amount of possibilities that you have for your actions. And this one, it's nice because you can just look at all your cards with your powers and it's like, oh, well, this is a full moon action, so I don't have to even think about that right now. Yeah. The other thing that's nice, I don't know if you mentioned this, but you get to start with a goal card that gives you
yes,
something to aim for. Like mine was, I had to get a project that was worth 6 credits,
yeah,
aka points.
And I needed 4 sorcery type projects, which I failed to do.
I wish you had gone for it because I had an ability that let me get points off of other people's sorcery cards. So that would have been fantastic.
Wow. Yeah.
I just needed 300 level. They treat it like, you know, a university setting, which I appreciate.
Yeah, there's three tiers of projects.
Yeah, 100 level.
200 and 300.
And I needed just to complete three 300 level projects, and I got 4 points. It wasn't a ton of points, but it was great being able to shoot for that.
Yeah, it gives you direction.
Yep.
Yeah, I think... So the moon phase thing is pretty interesting because, yeah, it is good for simplifying what you have to think about. It's also a neat alternative to the mechanic of cooldowns.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are games, I guess this is maybe more common in video games, but, well, no, it happens in board games too, where, like, you have an ability and you use your ability and then there's a cooldown period before you can use it again. Now... In a video game, this is quite easy to track, but in a board game, it means probably you're going to put some sort of counter and remove the counter each turn or something. But the cool thing about the moon phases is you don't need those counters. It's just, okay, are we in this phase? Great, I can do this thing. I actually made a game a while back, which was sort of inspired by Bomberman, where you're planting bombs, but the bombs went off at certain phases, so that you wouldn't have to have a cooldown timer. It's just like, okay, is it the red phase? Then all of the red bombs go off.
Yeah.
But you
don't.
That's
nice.
Yeah.
Did you do anything with that one?
No. I shelved it.
Yeah, that's cool.
But yeah, so the moon phase thing is a great alternative to cooldowns because you don't need to use any tokens to track the cooldown.
Right, yeah.
And another cool thing.
Yeah, and it's a little more interesting than just like, oh, once per round or. Mm-hmm. Like, we did already have those things with our staffs, which we started with a staff, and you could use that anytime once per round. That's kind of just, like, flexible thing. But, yeah, it's nice to have... Yeah, and sometimes it's like, oh, well, this ability would be better if it was twice per round. So, yeah, you just put it on, like,
two
different
moon
phases.
I had the one where it's both of the half moon phases.
Mm-hmm.
My ability worked.
I really like, too, that, you know, some of them, like, you can use your action to activate the ability on that moon phase, or you can have this passive ability if you're going to do something already.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it's like, technically, you had the half moon phases with Plague.
Yes.
But you would also not do that unless you were going to the graveyard, probably.
Right. Yeah. So for reference, Plague is an ability that lets me add a card to each of the grave piles on the half moon, when the moon is half full.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to do that, but generally I do that, if I'm going grave digging to get more options.
You wouldn't do that and then go buying a new project.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that would help us out potentially, and you typically don't want to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. One other cool thing about the moon phase restrictions is that if you have two abilities where they're absolutely broken together, you can just put them on different moon phases and then players... Can't
combine them. They can't link them.
Right. So it's one way that you can balance certain abilities. And it's just super thematic.
Yeah. Yeah. And I honestly, like, I was going to say this was going to be my takeaway before you even started talking about it. But I really like the idea of having a solid thematic reason for time occurring and what that thing is and being able to link things to that cycle, whatever it is. Moons are nice because it's nice and even and happens every month, but this we have it divided into four.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like being able to call on that and use that. I think that's a really cool thing to have in a game in general. But for engine builders especially, like then you can actually do different things at different times. And like you're saying, you don't want to have that linked with a different ability. So you put one at, you know, the full moon and one at the new moon.
Yeah.
But then you still feel good because you get to do these different abilities.
Yeah.
As long as you pay attention and see it. It's like, oh, that's really great.
And it's a great way to balance abilities by reducing their uptime.
Yeah.
So thinking about this as an engine builder, it just definitely has the feel of, like, you know, at the beginning it's pretty hard to get started. I mean, you're doing things, but, you know, you don't have much buying power yet. But, yeah, it definitely ramps up and turns end up being, like, you get a lot to think about.
You can chain things.
Yeah, chain chain combos. Trevor, you had some good
chain combos going off.
Yeah, there. Like especially when I did a lot of completion based projects. So when you complete it, you get a special benefit, and then that would allow me to make other things complete and trigger those as well, which felt really good.
Yeah,
and I really like having those chains happen.
Yeah. And completion projects are also they're quite nice when designing games because people don't have to think about them after they're done.
Right.
Whereas ongoing effects you do have to think about.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. And I really actually about like the ingredients having a dollar value, but you could go do it for free. I thought that was a great little add in here because, you know, a lot of times it's like, oh, well, I can't do anything because I have no money and so I can't go buying things or I need this specific resource to go do things. Going to the graveyard gives you money and the resource. It just is depending on what you need at that time because all of the resources have the money printed on the bottom of what they're worth. And you can just go to the – and maybe there's just one card. Maybe you can get a stack of three cards. And sometimes you get like relic things that are worth a lot of extra money.
Yeah, the jewelry that the dead people were wearing.
Yep, and so you get like $4 or $5 worth of things, and then you can go the next turn and go shopping with that stuff, which is kind of morbid, but like it feels nice mechanically.
Yeah, I think the Winston draft fits so well thematically here.
Yes,
because like the graves, you don't know what's in them. A lot of what's in them is probably worthless to you.
Right.
And you're, you know, if once you find something, you're probably not going to want to keep digging elsewhere.
Yeah, I imagine like you're digging with a shovel and you're knocking things loose as you dig. So that's the new stuff that you're creating there.
Yeah, exactly.
And you don't even know what you've dug up until after you leave and someone else comes through. It's like, oh man, they knocked this loose. Oh, this is great.
Yeah.
Yeah, it fits so well.
Yeah.
Winston drafts are a really cool mechanic. I want to try using them in a game. The thing I really like about the Winston draft is that it adds push your luck in a way that's very satisfying because, well, I think the key to making it work is having things that you really, really care about and things that you don't. Like each player has different things they really care about because then, you know, you can look at a stack of four cards, which sounds like it should be great, but then you're like, this is all worth it. I don't need any of this. I really need that worm to finish my project.
You and the worms.
I don't want to talk about the worms too much.
And then in the last round, gets handed three worms and doesn't want any of them.
I was desperate for worms the whole game and could not find them, even though they're supposedly the most common ingredient.
Yep.
Yeah, the Winston draft is my takeaway from this one and just how that worked in this game. It was really nice. And the other thing I realized right away was that there's a kind of a meta strategy where, I watched Ananda put that pile back. He didn't want any of those things. And I can look over at his goals
and I saw
he's opposite me. So I actually might want stuff in that pile.
Sure, sure.
It rewards you for paying attention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I stopped paying attention because I saw like... eventually there's just so many cards in front of you guys but I'd be curious to try a game that has basically just that Winston draft and like maybe a simpler collection. I like this whole game, but you know, it'd be interesting to see just that draft, so we're just like quickly, because this one is more like a small piece of the entire game.
Yeah, I'd say it's probably a solid third half.
The Winston draft is great, and I think the key to making it great is to make sure the rest of the game makes you desperate for certain things and not for others.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And not just like in that you need certain things, but like you need certain things right now. Because otherwise you might just grab whatever the largest pile is and hold it until you can find a use for it.
Right.
But a lot of the projects have a much greater benefit if you complete them earlier. Well,
the way the game is set up is you want to always be committing cards to your projects because you only have a limited amount of things you can commit.
So. Right, because you get two free commits each turn, and if you don't use them, they're gone.
Right.
Which I think actually might lead to my takeaway from this game, which is... So I've observed this previously on Heat, most particularly. But when you give players an opportunity that they may or may not be able to take advantage of, they will be desperate to take advantage of it every turn. Like, you are, so the example in heat is, in heat, when you're in a very, when your car is in a low gear, you can get rid of heat cards from your hand. But if you don't have any heat cards, you don't get to do that, which means players feel like, oh, I should be taking risks and taking on heat cards, because otherwise I'm going to waste the low gear. Right. And there's a very similar feeling in this game, which is, okay, I get to commit two ingredients for free every turn.
Right.
I mean, I can do it by cramming, but that takes an action, so I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So if I don't have two ingredients and a project that needs them every single turn, I am wasting resources. Players hate wasting resources.
Oh, yeah.
And that, yeah, that makes them desperate to have the ingredients they need for their projects.
I was feeling it.
Yeah. It's a great way of creating a time pressure. I guess, so the takeaway is that the recipe for making players really, really want to do things is give them an opportunity and then an opportunity that they can use or waste, and they will want to use it, so they don't waste it. And you can do that, like it does in this game, by just saying, okay, here's something you can do for free every turn if you have the resources.
Yeah. And hand in hand with that, like having a restriction on players. And yeah. In this game, the restriction is you can't commit more than...
Right.
Like,
yeah.
And you can't... You could have as many items in your hand as you want, but right. You would...
Only play
waste
two of them
if yeah. You're not, yeah.
Yeah, you can't just take the largest pile and hoard items until the end of the game, because you won't be able to finish all your projects.
Right.
So I think this is a fantastic way to get players to want things in games, which I think is very important. I noticed a couple other interesting things about this game, one of which is the way that the wild cards are set up. Because in this game, some of the ingredient cards you have can be used in multiple ways to satisfy different types of requirements, like skeletons that can be used to satisfy either a hand or a femur, for example, in a project that requires a hand or a project that requires a femur. And one interesting thing this game does is that wild cards may be worth different amounts depending on how you use them. For example, some of the cards have a hand and a femur, but the hand has a little plus one next to it, which means if you use it as a hand in a project, it's worth an extra point, the project is.
Right.
Yeah, those plus one, minus one tokens that you put on your projects, it's interesting. I haven't seen another game that really does that. And at first I was like, well, minus one, plus one, that's not a big deal. But it actually makes... it more like the gradation, I guess, of completing projects is more interesting, because it's like, well, rather than just a standard recipe completion, is like, well, I just need these three things. Okay, I got those three things. I'll put them on there. But it gives like an extra little bit of thinkiness to every
extra credit.
Extra credit, yeah. It, thematically, it works great, because it felt like, oh, I got a B rather than an A on this project.
Yeah. Right, right.
Yeah. Yeah, and, well, I guess the other thing about it, yeah, it gives you different ways to complete the project, and it also means that you want to use the wild cards in certain ways rather than others. One general issue I have with wild cards is that I feel that they give so much flexibility that they prevent players from being as creative, because if you have a wild card, you know, you can just do whatever. It's anything. Yeah. So the fact that these wild cards tell you, oh, you can use it in either of these ways, but it's better if you use it in this way.
Right.
I feel like that solves a lot of my general problem with wild cards, which is that they're just too flexible.
Yeah.
And that players don't need to make intelligent choices when they have them.
After we've talked about that on the podcast, can't remember which episode, but after we talked about the wild card thing, I was like, I've removed that from at least one game. And it's like, oh, this is just better.
Yeah. I removed it and then re-added it, because I actually did kind of need a wild in there.
Oh, sure.
That's life sometimes.
Yep. Yeah. I feel like there should always be a downside. Right. Well, either a downside to the wild card or like this game does, it's kind of a wild card, but you really want to use it in a particular way if you can.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
And they're like levels of wildness. Like it counts as either one of two or three things, not everything.
Yeah. But one of the ingredients counts as four different types of bone, but three of the types give you a minus one if you use it.
Mm-hmm.
Which also, the minus one tokens, so I had a way to get rid of them as part of my engine. I had an ability that let me remove a minus one and draw three cards.
As an action.
As an action, yes. And I guess we've talked about this a little bit before, but I think that players often enjoy getting rid of liabilities more than acquiring assets. And this is just another example of that.
And if you can do both, you get assets and remove a liability. It's like
that,
so great.
Yeah, removing a minus one genuinely feels better than adding a plus one, even though it's equivalent.
Right.
It's, I don't know, it's some psychological thing. But
yeah, my staff did that too. It's like, oh, the normal downside to doing this card is minus one. But
is that the alchemy thing?
The alchemy thing. Yeah. But I have the power to make it a plus one.
Yeah, alchemy potions have a theme. Each of the schools has like a different thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah. And I think we were playing with a lot of the expansions or all the expansions.
The expansion.
Yeah.
I mean, it's mostly just the divination expansion.
Oh, sure. With staffs, which is a micro.
Yeah, I think that's a mini expansion.
Yeah.
But the...
And it's like what I brought up with Wormspan. I think if you're making an engine builder game, you just want to have enough design space in what you're doing. And even though this game is not that complicated to understand, it has a lot of little nuances in the design that then they can make these weird expansions that make everything feel a little... Like, there's so many different types of powers, but they all felt pretty different.
Yeah. Yeah, and the schools feel different, too. Like, the alchemy school in particular, normally you can only commit one card at a time or you get a minus one token. Of course, you had a thing that let you bypass that. So one other cool thing about how the expansion in this game is the base game kind of foreshadows the expansions.
Oh.
Because the base game includes certain cards that belong to a school of magic, or I guess a subject matter in thematically, that there's only one card like that.
Oh.
Like, I had an artificery card.
Yeah.
It's the only one in the game.
Oh.
Because, hypothetically, there might be a future artificery expansion.
Oh, sure.
Similarly, Divinations is foreshadowed on a card in the base game before the Divinations expansion. So it's like, ooh, what's this subject? I don't see any other cards like that. Oh, it's a future expansion.
That's smart.
That's great.
And then for completionists,
now I have to know.
Yeah. Better buy this expansion.
Yeah. It teases that new mechanic then too, which is really fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One last piece I also want to make sure I bring up is the market and the kind of rotation through the level 100. You get four 100 level cards and then two 200 in the first round. Second round, you get four 200 and one or two 100. Sorry.
Yeah.
And like it just keeps improving and getting harder and harder, which, a lot of games have a kind of artificial way of doing that. That they try to make seem natural, and it never feels quite right. I was mostly thinking of Thunderstone does something like that. There's just like, it's hard to really get a good natural flow for it. And I think like you're in school, you completed a month. Now things get a little bit harder and you can get access to a little bit more powerful magic.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that feels really good and really right.
Yeah, that's a good point. Often it's just like, okay, we're done with the first phase
of
the game.
Deck.
So now discard all the bronze cards. Now we're bringing out the silver cards.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's this one we're like slowly phasing in. And we can still have access to the old stuff a little bit. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I really
like
that.
Yeah, I think I maybe used to be more opposed to like setting decks and having like multiple tiers of decks to like... feel like things are ramping up, but I think the ramp up, I'm working on a game right now where it really feels like it's needs those different decks.
Oh, sure.
To keep the game ramping up. And yeah, maybe it's a little more set up to do, but
it's not that much.
It's not
throw a deck and play. But right. Already, if you're playing an engine builder, it's probably not just one deck of cards.
Yeah.
Right.
So, like, you're already have leaned away from that concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it really does add an arc to the game.
It does. It really does.
Especially since in an engine builder, generally the late game cards you want to be things that are geared around getting points.
Right.
Since people are sort of... And whereas the early game cards are like setting up, what's my engine going to look like overall? Mm-hmm. Like, what is the cornerstone of my engine?
What's the structure?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, that's Studies in Sorcery. And tune in next time when we get to play Sprocket Forge.
What?
Yeah, stay tuned.
Hey, thanks for listening to The Tabletop Takeaway. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. So please tell your friends and visit our website at thetabletoptakeaway.com, where you can suggest games and mechanics for us to cover next on the show.